Well, if you have your Bible, please open it up to Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews chapter 4, verse 14 is where we'll be this morning. I want to begin by just reminding us of a truth many of us already know, which is the Christian life is not an easy life. The Christian life is not an easy life. There is, of course, we know in the Gospels, Jesus warning us, telling us that if we are to be followers of him, there will be persecution, there will be suffering. All those who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. There is that kind of difficulty that comes from living the Christian life. But that's not the only thing that makes it challenging. In fact, some of the times, it's actually not the thing that is most difficult about the Christian life. One of the things that actually makes the Christian life so difficult is not the things that happen to us from outside of us, but the things that are happening inside of us. One of the most difficult parts of the Christian life is realizing our own weakness. The longer you are a Christian, the more you begin to realize that God's standard that he sets, we fall so dismally short. There are so many times in our life, as a Christian, we know the path that God has called us. We know the holiness that he wants for us, and yet, still we continue to sin. We continue to turn our back on him. For many of us, there's sin that's been in our life that we know about, that we want to put to death. And it's been years, and there's still no progress. There's temptations that we fight. Sin that continues to come up over and over in our life, and it feels like, are we making any progress? Being a Christian is hard. It feels like I'm not living the way that I ought to live, and the temptation, sometimes, in those moments, is to feel like giving up. I don't know if you've ever felt that, but the moment when you perhaps you fall into sin again and you just wonder, is it worth it to keep going? Like, this Christian life is hard. Just had a conversation with a guy this week. There was a sin in his life, and there was a point at which he just kind of stopped trying. Because he really, it's too hard. I'm just going to give up because there's no way I'm going to be able to ever conquer this. But you just stop trying. There's a temptation even to just kind of want to throw in the towel with this whole Christian thing. Man, life would be so much easier if I didn't need to follow Christ. If I could just live how I wanted, life would be so much easier. The Christian life is not an easy life. What do we do when we feel like that? Where do we go? What encouragement can we draw? Well, we're going to be looking at the book of Hebrews today. And so again, Hebrews chapter 4, verse 14 is where we'll begin. And you've been in a series called Why Christmas the last 3 weeks, looking at different passages in the book of Hebrews that explain why does Christmas exist? Why did Jesus have to come? And today we will find, I hope, encouragement for us in the midst of this. The encouragement that the author of Hebrews is going to give to us is that we have a great high priest. There's not an ordinary high priest, a great one. And because we have this great high priest, we have hope and encouragement in the midst of our own difficulties. So let me read the passage together. We'll go from verse 14 all the way through chapter 5, verse 10. This is what the author writes. He says, "Since then, we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession." Let's hold on to the faith. Let's keep going. "Why? For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal gently with the ignorant and the wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness. Because of this, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for his own sins, just as he does for those of the people. And no one takes this honor for himself, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was. So also Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but he was appointed by him who said to him, "You are my son. Today I have begotten you." As he says in another place, "You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. And being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And so what we see here in this passage from the very first verse is that since we have a high priest, we should hold fast our confession. We should continue in this life. And then he begins to tell us about the high priest, all these things about the kind of high priest we have. So what is it about our high priest that makes us want to hold fast our confession, to continue in the faith? Two things to highlight. Two things about the high priest. Here's the first one. Our high priest sympathizes. Our high priest sympathizes. Look again at verse 15. It says, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin." And so the author writes it in kind of a weird way. He has this double negative. We do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize. But it's kind of written in a way that you would almost expect the author to say, okay, well, we have a high priest who is unable to sympathize. That would be kind of the expected response, perhaps, of the people. And his point is, no, we don't have a high priest who is unable to sympathize. Because if you know about Jesus from the book of Hebrews, your first instinct should be not that he sympathizes with us, but that he is so much greater and far above us, how could he ever sympathize with us? Look at chapter 1, verse 3. Talking of Jesus, it says, "He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. And he upholds the universe by the word of his power. After making purifications for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become as much superior to angels as the name he has inherited is far more excellent than theirs." And so if you read that, you're like, of course he doesn't sympathize with us in our weaknesses. He's the one who is the exact imprint of God's nature. We don't expect a king to be able to understand and sympathize with the plight of the poor. We don't expect the child who's raised in the billionaire's home to know what it really means to live paycheck to paycheck. We wouldn't normally expect that. We wouldn't expect the king of the universe to be able to understand and sympathize with us in our human weakness and frailty. But with human priests, it was expected. It was normal. In fact, that's what we see as we look at chapter 5, verse 1. It gives the job description of the priest. It says, "For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sin." So he's going to represent the people to God. And then it says, "He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness." So the idea is this human priest, if you think of the Levitical priesthood in Israel with the temple, the tabernacle, these priests are offering sacrifices for the people. And the idea is he has understanding, his sympathy for the people, because he himself knows himself to be a sinner. You know, there's some guy who's coming to the temple, and you know, there's lots of things that you would, you know, laws that you might break that you need to bring a sacrifice for. He brings a pigeon, he brings a bird, and he brings it the next day, and the next day, because he's broken this law again and again and again. And the idea is the priest, ideally, would be able to sympathize, be able to understand, deal gently with this guy, and not be like, oh, you're coming again? No, because he knows himself. There's sacrifices he needs to make for his own sins. And so when people come, this priest can deal gently with him. Which I think, if we just pause for a moment, is really helpful for us to think about in our own lives and our own interactions with others in the church. It says the high priest can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward, since he himself is beset with weakness. For all of us as Christians, there are those who are weak within the church. And those who are beset with weakness are going to deal gently with those who are weak. There's a temptation when maybe we're walking alongside somebody, maybe we're discipling somebody, maybe we're walking through a difficult marriage with someone, maybe we're just discipling our teenagers. There can be a tendency to get frustrated, a tendency to be impatient because we're hoping to see progress in the marriage. We're hoping that they'd be able to put this sin to death, and it's been a long time and it hasn't happened yet. They keep coming back with the same problems. The marriage struggles continue. They keep getting angry at their children. And we can be kind of frustrated, like, why isn't there anything changing? Except that we know that ourselves are sinners also. That we are people who've simply received God's grace. So we're not going to be harsh. We're not going to get frustrated or upset because we know who we ourselves are. We are beset with weakness. And so we want to be able to deal gently. Which doesn't mean that there aren't times where hard words need to be spoken, where people who are unrepentant sin need to be warned. Those things have to happen. But on the whole, our relation towards others in the church that we are helping to follow Jesus is one where we are dealing gently. I remember one time I was sitting in an elders meeting. I was just sitting in watching, and the elders were discussing among themselves some issue that was going on in a person's life. And there was a kind of older elder pastor in the room, and he was listening. He wasn't part of directly interacting with this particular individual and their sin, so he was just kind of hearing from the other elders, and they were kind of trying to discern. It was a difficult situation. How should they approach it? How should they talk to him? Did there need to be, you know, moving towards church discipline? Was it just, you know, what was going on? And his question to the other elders was, do you think that this is a weak sheep or a rebellious sheep? And I thought that was a really good question to think about, because we're all described as sheep, and as the shepherds trying to shepherd the flock, there's a different approach you take with a rebellious sheep who seems to just be pushing back, or there's a weak sheep who's just, you know what, they keep falling into sin, and they do it over again, but there's a repentant heart, there's a weakness there that we want to come and help alongside. So we ourselves need to remember that Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners, and like Paul, of whom I am the foremost. We can deal gently with those ignorant and those who are wayward. But if we think again for a moment about this human priest, the point that the author of Hebrews is making is the human priest can identify with the weakness of the people because he himself is weak. But this presents a problem. Look at verse 3. Because of this, his own weakness, he is obligated to offer sacrifice for his own sins, just as he does for those of the people. Okay, so you've got this weak priest, but this weak priest needs to offer sins for himself and then also the people. So he can enter into the temple and into God's presence, but this seems to kind of be an only like a temporary solution. He can lead us into the temple, but not really into everlasting life, because he himself is weak. He has to have sacrifices for his own sins. There needs to be somebody else to take the wrath of his sins. He's still a loser, like us. And we need a winner who can bring us out of the situation that we are in. And so here's the beauty of what the author of Hebrews is writing about Jesus. He's saying that Jesus understands our weakness, not because he himself is weak, not because he's a loser like us, but because he's strong. Look again at verse 15. We do not have a high priest who's unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. So he went through the same kinds of things we went through, but he did it in a way that showed himself strong. So he understands what it is like to be tempted. He understands that pressure, but he's done it in a way that he didn't sin. To which we might say, well, then does he really understand? If he didn't sin, if he was just able to go through life and everything was really easy for Jesus, then does he really understand what we're going through? This is how C.S. Lewis responds in his book, Mere Christianity. He says, it is a silly idea, is current, that good people do not know what temptation means. This is an obvious lie. Only those who try to resist temptation know how strong it is. After all, you find out the strength of the German army by fighting against it, not by giving in. You find out the strength of a wind by trying to walk against it, not by lying down. A man who gives in to temptation after 5 minutes simply does not know what it would have been like an hour later. That is why bad people, in one sense, know very little about badness. They have lived a sheltered life by always giving in. We never find out the strength of the evil impulse inside us until we try and fight it. And Christ, because he was the only man who never yielded to temptation, is also the only man who knows to the full what temptation means. The only complete realist. And so what C.S. Lewis is saying is because Jesus resisted temptation, he didn't give in right away. He experienced the fullness of that temptation to its absolute maximum. And yet he never sinned. The Bible is clear that even though Jesus went through all of this in thought, word, or action, he never gave in. 1 John 3:5 says, speaking of Jesus, you know that he appeared in order to take away sin, and in him there is no sin. Just think about this for a moment. And you think about your own life. You think about the temptations that you face daily, weekly. You know the force of them. You know how they seem to dangle the bait in front of you, offering this satisfying thing that never turns out to be what you thought it was. There's temptations that we give into just kind of automatically. Something happens and there's an outburst of anger. It just seems to be something that happens. Or sometimes it's a temptation that we know something's wrong, and yet it's minutes or it's hours or days that we're fighting, wrestling. Is this, should I do this? Is this right? I know it's not, and I want to, but I know it. We know what Satan's power is like. We know the pull towards sin. And we know that in far too often in our own lives we give in. Whether it's anger or greed, gossip, coveting. We're like the Olympic, weightlifter who tries to lift the barbells, and we get up a little bit, we resist the temptation to a bit, and then we drop it, and we say, I give up. Where Jesus is the one who brings the weight above his head, and he just keeps holding it, and holding it, and holding it. He never gives in. He never lets it go. And what is most amazing about this is that response of Jesus motivates sympathy. Because it doesn't have to be like that. He did it perfectly. He completely resisted temptation, and we didn't, and somehow that motivates him to be sympathetic towards us. But if you think for a moment of kids in school, and you're like, you got a bunch of kids and they got to run like a 5K race. There's usually kind of like two groups of people. There's the kids who run the 5K and they're running the whole time. It's fun. It's easy. It's no problem. They get to the finish. They're laughing, joking. Then there's the kids who are forced to run a 5K, but who don't want to run, who aren't athletically gifted. They're walking the whole way, or they gave up. They kind of left the race halfway and they said, I'm not doing this. What doesn't usually happen is the kids who finished the race, who it was no problem for, they went through, they're not like, oh man, I'm so sympathetic towards the kid who dropped out. No, they're usually, they've kind of formed their own little group of people. They kind of do their thing and they kind of look down maybe on the people who never finished the race. Here we've got Jesus, who went through more temptation than any of us can experience. And instead of lording it over us, instead of sticking it in our face and saying, guys, you didn't resist, instead, he sympathizes. He doesn't make us feel bad. His response isn't to tell us, you should do better. The author says, because he has been tempted as we are and yet resisted, this is a motivation for pity, compassion, sympathy. When we are going through temptations, he resonates with that. He understands the difficulties of the things we're walking through. And he chose to use his experience of temptation as a greater identification with us. Not as a way to create more distance, but to create less. To come close to us. Because he knows our difficulties. And he knows them in an experiential way, not in like a textbook way. He knows what it's like to go through the things you're going through. If you've ever experienced profound grief in your life, then I think you know what I mean. If you've experienced the loss of a parent or child or spouse, then you know how much it hurts. And you know the sorrow and the pain and the grief. And you know that there are some really well-meaning people who come up to you and say, I know what you're feeling. It must be so hard. And your response to them is, no, you have no idea what I'm feeling. You've not gone through what I've gone through. You don't know what it's like. But then you meet some people. Some people who have also lost a spouse or a child or a parent. And usually in those moments, there's not a lot of things that they have to say. But if you know that they've also lost someone like that close to them, they can say things to you like, it must be so difficult. And you know that they know. They know what it's like. Because the situations might not be exactly the same, but that experience of sorrow and grief, you know that they've been through it. And so you know when they sympathize with you, it's real. They actually understood it. It's not just they understand that grief is something that's hard. They know that grief is hard. And Jesus came into the world partly, not fully, but partly so that he could go through the things that we go through. So that when we're going through the things we're going through, we know that he knows. He actually understands in an experiential way the temptations we face. The difficulty of resisting sin. The difficulty of walking faithfully to the Lord. So our high priest sympathizes. But it's not really a great thing if our high priest just understands and sympathizes with us, but he can't actually do anything to help us. If you've got somebody who, you know, you're stuck in the quicksand and they're stuck in the quicksand also, it's not great that you both know what it's like to be stuck in quicksand. You need someone who can pull you out of the quicksand. And this is the great thing about Jesus. Not only does our high priest sympathize, but our high priest saves. Point number two, our high priest saves. If we look down at verse 9 and 10, we see that clearly in the text. It says of Jesus, and being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And this is really what kind of the verses from, you know, 4 onwards begin to explain, this idea that Jesus has become this high priest that can save us, but he's been designated, appointed that by God because he's perfect. That is why he is able to save. So let's look through the verses together. If we start at verse 4, it begins to talk about the appointment that God gives for priests. In verse 4 it says, and no one takes this honor for himself, the honor of being priest, but only when called by God, just as Aaron was. Aaron was Moses' brother, and in Exodus 28, we see that God sets Aaron and his sons aside to be the high priests over Israel, the main priests who are going to mediate God's people to God. But of course, this doesn't go great, because Aaron, if you remember, that's the golden calf guy. That's while Moses is up on the mountain receiving these instructions. He's down, you know, oh, I just threw some gold into the fire and out came a calf. That guy. Right. Also, his sons, Nadab and Abihu, we're told that they offer an unauthorized fire, a strange fire, some kind of unauthorized offering, and they are killed immediately by the Lord. We see throughout the history of Israel, there's a lot of corrupt priests. Priests who don't seem to deal gently with the people. A lot of people who use the priesthood for their own advantage. So this is not great. And so it prompts this need for a different kind of priesthood. Not a priesthood of Aaron, but another kind of priesthood. And this is what verse 5 tells us. So also Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but he was appointed by him, who said, you are my son, today I have begotten you. As he says also in another place, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So two psalms that are quoted, Psalm 2 and Psalm 110, about God's appointment of Jesus and this order of Melchizedek. We don't have time to go into Melchizedek and do a whole thing, but if you want, just read Hebrews 7 and Genesis 14, and that kind of gives you a good idea of who Melchizedek is. But he's basically this guy that in Genesis 14, Abraham, he's just conquered these kings, he's coming back, and there's this king who shows up who's also called a priest of God Most High. Abraham offers some tithes to him, and then we don't see him anymore. He's like Cotton Eye Joe. Where did he come from? Where did he go? We have no idea. And you don't hear about him until Psalm 110, until you hear that there's going to be this priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So you know there's the priesthood of Aaron, and then there's this other kind of priesthood that's promised. Not the order of Aaron, but the order of Melchizedek. A different kind of priest. And this is what the author of Hebrews is saying, that Jesus is not a priesthood in Aaron's line. He's not a priesthood that does the laws and customs written in the Mosaic law, but he's going to be a different kind of priest. And Melchizedek is a type, a pattern of what that is like. And then Hebrews 5, 7, and 9, our next few verses, tell us a little bit more about why can Jesus be this high priest. It says, in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who is able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverence. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered, and being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. So we see that Jesus, he says, he offered up prayers to him who was able to save him from death and was heard, which seems weird because Jesus died, but we should understand when he would save him from death, from ultimate death, Jesus, through his resurrection and ascension, God answered these prayers. But then it says that Jesus learned obedience and that he was made perfect. What does that mean? Well, we know what it doesn't mean. We know it doesn't mean that when it says Jesus learned obedience, it was Jesus was disobedient and then he learned to be obedient. Or he wasn't perfect and then he became perfect. Because we literally just a few verses earlier said Jesus is without sin. So it can't be that. So when it says Jesus learned obedience through what he suffered, he was made perfect, it means that Jesus' obedience was kind of abstract until it was made concrete through his obedience to God. As he walked through suffering, his obedience showed itself. Every time there was those who threatened against him or hit him or mocked him, it was an opportunity, a temptation that Jesus needed to resist to remain faithful and true to God. He showed through the testing the perfect obedience that was already there within his character. And the logic of this passage is because Jesus is perfect, then he can be the source of eternal salvation. Because not only, if he is perfect, does he not need to offer a sacrifice for himself, like these other priests, but Jesus can actually be the sacrifice for the people. If we jump ahead to Hebrews chapter 7, you'll see that as the author kind of expands the argument of what this means, he goes into detail to explain what a wonderful high priest we have. He says in verse 26, "For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest." Look how he's described: holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners. He's perfect. He's awesome and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for the people. Why? Since he did this once for all, when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priests. It's Aaron. But the word of the oath, God's promises that we just heard quoted, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever. Now the point in what we are saying is this: we have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord has set up, not man. And so we have this perfect high priest who's offered up himself and who has brought us not into the holy places of a temple or a tent. He's brought us into the things that those things represented. He's brought us into heaven itself, into the very presence of God. And it is because of his perfection, because he can be a perfect sacrifice that on the cross can absorb all of the wrath of God that we deserve, and that therefore us who are sinful and deserve that wrath can be credited with Jesus' righteousness. That we can walk into God's throne room not having, you know, the name badge that says sinner, but a name badge that says Jesus, the righteous. We've been given a righteousness that's not our own, a righteousness that we are clothed in to be able to enter into the presence of God. And that is how he can be a source of eternal salvation. Because he did not give in to temptation. He was perfect. And that perfection means he can be punished for our sins and we can be given his righteousness. So here's our application as we close. If all of that is true, if we have such a great high priest, what should we do? The answer is in verse 16. Draw near to the throne of grace. Draw near to the throne of grace. Look at verse 16. Let us then, with confidence, draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. It says we can draw near with confidence. There's sometimes, I think, in our own minds, a hesitation of thinking that we can actually come to God, especially when we're, you know, struggling and in the midst of our own sin. It says we can have confidence. We hesitate because we don't feel like we should be there in God's presence. Right, we think of, you know, the story of Esther and the king. She doesn't want to enter into the presence of the king because the king can, you know, just say a word and she's dead. Unless he holds out his scepter. There's a fear of entering into the presence of the king, especially the Most High King. But Hebrews tells us we can approach with confidence We can come to God, not because of us, but because of our great high priest. We can come to this throne, a throne that's described as a throne of grace, not a throne of justice or of wrath or of judgment, a throne of grace. One where our high priest sits at the right hand of the majesty on high, always living to make intercession for us. This is the main thing to think about Jesus. He's in the throne room of God now. And he's not like the other priests who, you know, they went into the holy place once a year and then they had to come out and they had to offer sacrifices for sins and then they go back in. Jesus entered in once for all, sits down at the right hand of God, and he's there making intercession for us now and always. He's not going to leave. He's not going anywhere. He is pleading that because of him, those who are in him, those who have believed and trusted in him, are righteous before God, and therefore we can always enter into God's presence. We can always come to the Lord in prayer. The access way is open. The throne room doors have been thrown open. The veil has been torn. And he says, we can draw near. Why? So that we can receive mercy and find grace. All of our sins, forgiven. Past, present, future. He saves. And we know that when we enter into that throne room, we don't need to feel ashamed. We don't need to feel like, I don't know if they're going to understand why I've been struggling with this. No, we know that there is a high priest who's not only saying these people are righteous, but he's one who knows exactly what we've been through. So we can find mercy and find grace in help to help in time of need. So what need do you have right now? What is the thing in your Christian life that is most difficult? Will you draw near? Will you come to the Lord in prayer? With confidence. Not ashamedly, not abashedly. He knows what's going on. You don't need to be ashamed. He knows. But you in his eyes are righteous because our high priest saves and our high priest sympathizes. So draw near. Why Christmas? Why does Jesus come? He comes down to us so that we can draw near to him. Let me pray. Father, this prayer is such a privilege. There's no reason you should listen to our requests because of us, but only because Jesus has come, he's died in our place, he's resurrected, he's ascended, and he's at the throne, that we now have your ear. And so we ask, O Lord, would you give us confidence to boldly come and to ask you and to receive the grace and mercy you promised to give us in our help of time of need so that we can resist the temptations in our life. We can be faithful to you. Help us, O Lord, so that Jesus Christ will receive all the glory. We ask in his name, amen.